Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is producer Rob Schnapf. But first, let's talk about Adele and how she broke a couple of records this week. Adele sold 3 million albums this week, which is the most of any artist ever since they've been keeping track of this. Not only that, in the UK, she also broke the record there too, with 800,000 sold. This is a pretty big deal from the standpoint that everybody said that, first of all, albums were over. No one would ever buy as many albums again. Sales were over, and in fact, what we're going to have is streaming forever. And that may in fact be true, but there's still some people out there that prefer to buy, and we're seeing it right now. Now, if you look at Adele's last album, which was called 21, she sold 31 million copies worldwide. People had said that we'd never see another 10 million sale ever again. And here she blew right past that. And it's entirely possible she'll blow by it again, this time with her album 25. But when you look at things, it's not quite as black and white as it might seem. First of all, 54% of the people that bought Adele's albums bought the digital version, in other words, the download version, and the rest bought the CD. If you might think that the CD is coming back, well, for now it might, but the fact of the matter is, this is a dying format that sooner or later is destined to go away. Why do I say that? Well, first of all, it's hard to find players anymore. So if you look at the brand new cars that are coming out, you don't find CD players in them. If you look at computers, you haven't seen a disk drive in quite a while. So these are items that are not everyday items anymore. And as a result, you're going to see CDs really bought and sold more as memorabilia than anything else. All that being said, Adele missed a big opportunity because her album was not released to the on-demand streaming services. It's available on Pandora. It's available on YouTube. So you can get it on various streaming services, but you can't get it on Spotify or Apple Music or any of the on-demand streaming services. And this is an opportunity lost. The reason why, if she would have released it just on streaming, it actually would have driven her fans, the ones that haven't signed up for any of the online streaming services, it would have driven her fans to do so. And that would have been better for everybody in the music business to really speed that along. Instead, what we found is the dash for cash in order to squeeze the last dollars, the last big piece of profit out of any kind of physical sales. And that's a shame because really this could have been a turning point for streaming. And in fact, it's just a little bit more of the same old thing. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. You can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. The next thing I want to talk about is something called Li-Fi, L-I-F-I, and that's short for Light-Enabled Wi-Fi. Yes, what this is really fast Wi-Fi done via light. This uses a technology called VLC, Visible Light Communications, which has actually been used for quite a while because most of the data that goes around the world goes over fiber optic cables, which is basically transmitting light. We're doing the same thing here, only on an advanced sort of Wi-Fi, now called Li-Fi. And just to show you how fast this could be and what an advancement it could be, when this was demonstrated by one of the people that came up with it, they had one single LED and one photodiode. Just with those two small components, he was able to get a 50 meg bandwidth, enough to stream movies, no problem. In fact, people think that it's possible that the bandwidth can go as high as 224 gigs, which is amazing. And they're thinking, for instance, that 1 gig bandwidth is nothing in comparison to what's theoretically possible. So if this does happen, and again, they think in 3 years it will be commercially available, this could have a big impact on the entertainment world because it'll be easy to actually stream, for instance, high-res music. There will be no more need for MP3s, AAC, anything like that, because you'll be able to stream whatever you'd like in terms of PCM. 96K, no problem. 192K, no problem, because you have the bandwidth and you got plenty of it. Same thing with movies. You want a 4K movie, you want to stream it, no problem. So this can be a really big deal. It's called Li-Fi. So look out for it because it's the next big thing. My guest today is producer Rob Schnoff, who has a penchant for vintage gear and has some great credits with Beck, Elliott Smith, The Vines, Booker T. Jones, many more. I talk with Rob from his studio in Los Angeles. Tell me how you get into producing. How did you go to your first producing job? How did it happen?
Well, I'd always been in bands, and it was something I've always wanted to do. Like, I don't know, I started being interested in records, like how they were put together, probably back when I was 13. And so, you know, I used to listen to them. But it was a big mystery. You know, I didn't understand it at all. But anyway, I got a job in a studio in D.C. And I used to drag my band in there. And it was, I think it was like good timing because we were a young band and we're also learning how to write songs. And while I'm learning how to record, and the two kind of came together, you know, and it was like in the studio, everybody, you know, we'd have the song and you'd have the intro, the riff, the verse, the pre-chorus, the chorus, the bridge, the solo. There was like every little Dakota, the retard, the breakdown. It was like you were just experimenting with all the little different songwriting things, and you'd be left with the song and working on it and be like, man, this is boring. So I would just start to, you know, edit out parts or shorten sections and you know, just to keep the energy going. And that's kind of how I, you know, and through that discovery, it was like, oh yeah, okay. You know, learned about song arranging through the razor blade.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I kind of started the same way. Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, when you're in the band, you don't always have the perspective because you're playing.
Yeah.
So it's like hearing it back. It's like, oh, okay. Yeah, that is boring. Why do we need 32 bars of that?
Yeah. So are you from the D.C. area?
I grew up in New Jersey, originally from the Bronx.
Oh, where in New Jersey?
A town called Matawan.
Oh, I know Matawan, sure.
Yeah. Well, where are you from?
Well, I'm from Pennsylvania, but I lived at the Jersey Shore for a while, and I played all over North and South Jersey for, you know, a number of years, so I know
where,
the area really
where
well.
Where in Jersey did you live?
I lived all the beach towns, Asbury Park, Belmar, Point Pleasant, Manasquan, which I still love.
Yeah.
All those.
Wow. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
And I think Manasquan and Long Beach were my, and LBI were my two favorites.
Yeah, and there are always so many great places that you could play at there as well, which, you know, it's not quite the same anymore, but at one point in time, man, you know, there's lots of cool places in the summer and the winter too.
So when were you there?
It was late 70s I was there, and then I circled back around before I moved to California. Well, I guess it was late 70s, really.
Wow, the heyday.
Yeah, it really was. It was great. As a matter of fact, my band used to play at the Stone Pony, and Springsteen would come in and jam with us, as well as the E Streeters and Southside and, you know, his band.
What was your band?
It's called The Other Side.
Yeah. You remember Bystander?
I do, yes. Is that you?
No. It's just, I remember that band. They were, I think, from Freehold or something. So yeah. They were like the town over.
Yeah.
That was like a...
Yeah, yeah. Small world, huh? Well,
that's
cool.
Crazy.
How did you make it out to California?
I was in a band. We did all we could do in D.C. and it was time to go someplace and just ended up out here. And then I thought I was going to do that. And then I got pulled back into the studio. Somehow, I think we broke up, and then I didn't know what else to do.
So I got
a job at the record plant.
Oh well, hey, good place to get a gig at.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, you know, as a runner or a janitor, as they like to call it.
When was that?
And
when was that?
That was like 87.
Uh-huh. That's the heyday of metal.
Yeah, which I was not into. I liked like the bands I was into. I was into like the Replacements and the Pixies and all that kind of alternative stuff. And while it had been bubbling under in the 80s,
yeah,
you know, it was kind of so 87 was the peak of the 88, peak of the hair metal. And then you had Guns N' Roses come out, which was sort of the first call to arms to get back to, you know, the first correction.
Yeah.
And then Nirvana, and that was it, done, over.
Yeah, right.
Like that, too. It was just like, that's over.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. There's been a lot of stuff like that in the music and the audio business. The one thing, just getting the gear for a second, remember 3324s and 3348s?
Oh, my God.
The multi-track digital, Sony digital machines. And it was like every studio had to have one. And then just that fast, it was over. Like in 6 months, they were dead.
I saw a 3348 selling for $1,200.
That's amazing.
That was what, $250,000?
Yeah. Yeah, right. And it was state of the art for half a second.
Yeah. Crazy.
Well, you know, let's take a left turn here for a second. I want to talk more to you about, you know, your producing career, but I was looking at your website and boy, you have a lot of really neat vintage gear. And I spotted that MCI 428. I grew up on a 416, so I
oh,
know
wow.
those really well. And mm-hmm. But yours is really hot rodded.
Yeah, super, super kind of from the front to the back. I mean, there were some things that are really archaic about it that just didn't make sense anymore. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't even understand, like, what would you do?
Yeah, right.
How would you? And I grew up on tape, and I still didn't understand, like, their concept. But, it, you know, it was the first inline console, so I think it was new to everybody, and some of those ideas were bad. But there were things about the console, like, the Transformers sound great.
Yeah.
Absolutely. They're just magical. But there were funny things, like fader driving into the EQ instead of, you know, yeah, there was just some archaic stuff in there. John Musgrave basically redesigned, or I don't know, it's a giant science project. 8 amplifiers got added. The monitor can dump into the stereo bus, so it's a 28, but it's really a 56.
Yeah,
because the way it used to be was the line amp would either be on the fader or the monitor.
Right.
That was it. You couldn't have both because there was only one. Rechipped, kind of re-architectured the power supply and the power distribution and the grounding. It's amazing. The low end goes down to zero. and then the quad bus, I always wanted, you know, when you had like, back in the day, we had an API Dimidio and it had a quad bus.
Yeah.
And this is when dealing with tape, that Dimidio was super slow. So I'd always wanted to take the quad bus and break it into 2 stereo buses that, yeah, you know, to make one transformerless and have one with the transformers, then you could adjust the speed accordingly.
Yeah.
But this was a variation on that theme. And so this quad bus got broken into vintage Neve. Is one stereo bus, and the other one is the is like Sunset Sound, you know, Jensen 990s hi-fi.
Wow.
Oh, the interesting thing was, so in theory, I was like, oh, that way, you know, you put the drums and the bass on the Neve and the pretty stuff on the, or whatever, you know, you mm-hmm. have these 2 different colors. But John Musgrave made this little series parallel switch, and I was doing this Booker T record, and I was just making rough mixes and experimenting, just trying to figure out what when it first finally came together, I was trying to figure out what the groove would be on the board. And I discovered this magical little thing, which was you assign the mix to both stereo buses, and then you take the hi-fi bus and you drive it into the Neve, and it saturates it and it makes it open up.
Wow.
And it does like this transformer saturation. So it's like a form of compression, and, but it's cooler than, I mean, it's, you know, not artifacty like bus compression.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you drive the Neves and that's what opens them up. So you don't get the, you know, that Neve, some people say warmth.
Yeah,
it's just this magical thing. I had no idea that was going to end up with that, but it's been a secret weapon.
Yeah, it sounds very cool. I was looking at your equipment list and it's very cool and it's very eclectic. And it makes me want to ask you, when you buy a piece of gear, are you buying it for need or are you buying it because it's collectible or it's cool or you sort of find it?
Oh, I don't care about it. It's all function for me.
Uh-huh.
I mean, from guitars and amps to everything, it's just function. Or, you know, it's like inspiration. It's not collecting at all. If something's too expensive, it just doesn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I love a Fairchild, but I'm never, it's not that good to me.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I don't know. It just doesn't make sense. It's not practical, especially in this day and age. You know, you have to kind of be measured with your reality. You can't just throwing away money at gear for no good reason.
Well, especially with the budgets that are
Yeah, that's
around.
What I mean. Like, it doesn't make sense. I'd never pay that off.
Yeah, yeah. Let's get back to production for a second. So what's your pre-production like?
Learn songs, tighten arrangements, or go, you know, just learn the songs, become familiar, make all those adjustments before we go in.
Mm-hmm.
Fiddle around, you know, maybe this needs an extra chord here or there. Maybe this is cool to do all that stuff so that when we're in the studio, we're recording, we're not pre-producing.
And how long does it take you generally? Do you do a record fast? Or are you meticulous about it? Because there's two schools of thought. I mean, one, you know, the one school of thought is let's get it absolutely perfect. And the other one is let's capture the feel, you know, and live with, you know, whatever the imperfections are.
I try to do what the music wants. So I'll do both.
Uh-huh.
But there's, you know, sometimes there's music that, you know, or an artist or a band that it makes sense to, like, they're ready to go and they got a thing and you want to capture it and go.
Yeah.
Then there's other times where, I don't know, it just seems like you need to send out the probe and take some time. And one isn't better than the other. You know, it's just kind of responding to the music. So I try not to really have a thing because I don't know, if you do the same thing every time, it gets boring.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, that's why I don't even want to do the same kind of music. I like having a nice varied, I like working on different kinds of music. I like music.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's easy to go, well, this is my chain. This is what I do. I'm going to, that's the guitar. Then I'm going to take this and put it in that. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always use the Les Paul through that Marshall and blah, 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 put the, you know, it, then, you end up with a sound and it's your sound. It's not the band. I don't know. So I kind of like to make adjustments and respond to the band.
Do you have any tricks for getting the best out of a player or a vocalist? Or not tricks, you know, technique?
Well, so technically speaking, there's the one thing, which is pitch comes from vowels.
Mm.
And those are the sounds you want to be hanging out on, not the consonant sounds.
Mm-hmm.
So technically that helps. And then the other side of it is just like you have to, it's got to be believable. You know, it's gotta make it past the glass.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a test for that?
Well, I don't know. It's just something you go for, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you know when you believe it or you don't.
Yeah, yeah.
Or, well, and not even believe, maybe that's not the right word. But, you know, it's feels like something happened. You know, because isn't that the record is you're just collecting moments.
Yeah.
And then you're putting them all together. So
that's a good way to think about
it. Yeah. So I don't know. Try to keep that in mind.
When you're tracking, do you like having the whole band or
again,
would you rather
it really, it really depends on the band. Like, if there's two guitar players and a keyboard player, and they've never ever listened to one another before till they're in the studio, no. Which, you know, a lot of times at young bands, everybody's got their part, but it's based on, you know, them. It's not based on the song.
Yeah.
So I like to record with the barest, like the most, just with the backbone that is required to get us to get the feeling. And if that requires everybody, then that's what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But if it doesn't require everybody, then that's what I want to do.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, that makes sense. That's a perfect way to do it, really.
How do you do it?
Again, it depends. And I've done it a lot of different ways. Recently, I've gone with one particular project. I've gone to just doing guitar and a vocal and the drums just to get the drums. And it's only because the most solid that way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, so it just depends. Right. Mm-hmm. And, some people have a methodology and they plan everything out and that's how they do it. And that's what works for them. And I like just make sure we got the framework together. And then I like inspiration and the song I really like that. It makes it exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's so cool when you're in the studio, though, and there's that exciting moment where everybody goes, wow, you know, and you get that chill. Because it doesn't happen that often, and you got to capture it when it does happen.
Exactly. And that's the thing, sort of like, if you're too preconceived, just my theory, this is my theory for me, anyway. If you're too preconceived, then you're not always... what's the way? Like you're chasing what it is and you're not open to what it is.
Good way to put it.
So it's just, you know, I'd like to just keep the antenna up.
Now, let's go back to when you work with Beck for a second. The rumor is that you saw him in a club just playing by himself and something caught your ear. Is that the way that worked?
So there's two. So Margaret Middleman, who is my wife, but she managed Elliot Smith and had a nice storied career in the music business.
Yeah.
We were at the Sunset Junction, you know, the Silver Lake Street Fair thing.
Yeah.
And there was the Hully Gully stage, and this kid would get up in between bands and then, you know, get chased off when it was, you know, the next... So we would get up while the next band was setting up, and just saw that, and it was Beck, and he just played these fucked up songs, cut in half blues. I can't even remember them, but and the guitar's kind of out of tune, but it was all, the words were really sort of, I don't know, it reminded me of his words were like an R. Crumb drawing. You know, you'd always see the power lines in the background. It was just like had the Urban Decay all over it. And Margaret gave him his car, gave him her card. He didn't even know what to do with it. And then about a month later, Tom Rothrock, my old partner, saw him do the same thing at Jabberjaw, just get up in between bands. And then we just made this connection and it was like, oh yeah. And that's kind of what happened.
Yeah. And with Elliot Smith, you had a long career with him. Was that connection through your wife then?
Well, let's see. So Slim Moon, who ran Kill Rock Stars, said, you got to check out this guy. And again, it was at Jabberjaw. but it was like, he was playing, it was like this spoken word, sort of like this punk rock spoken word tour. And he was playing on it. It was like this weird thing. It was, there wasn't much music.
Mm-hmm.
And, so Margaret and I went down there to see him. And I didn't know. I mean, I'd heard of Heat Miser, but I didn't know anything about his music.
Mm-hmm.
And man, it was like the very first song. It was a song called Needle in the Spoon.
Mm-hmm.
And fuck, it was devastating. It was like, whoa. I don't even know how to describe it. Because now it sounds like bullshit, but I was really transfixed by it.
Yeah. Isn't that so cool when that happens?
It really is. Because, you know, like you said, it doesn't happen often.
Yeah.
But, man, it's really cool when it does.
Did you?
And then so
go ahead.
Margaret and him started working together, and I, you know, whatever, they had their relationship, and then he started talking to me about recording, and I think he really liked "Pay No Mind," that song on Mellow Gold.
Mm-hmm.
And we all went to South by Southwest together. This, Margaret was working at BMG, so she had the expense account. So she had the hotel room, and it was like, and there was probably like 8 people in our hotel room, and Mary Lou Lord and Elliot, they didn't have any gigs at South By. They just went down there and busked every night. And it was really cool. And that's basically what we did. We just hung out while they went back and forth. They just handed the guitar back and forth to one another, played songs all night long with the guitar case open. And it was awesome. And that's really when our relationship started.
Mm-hmm. Did you go in the studio right away?
Did we go in the studio right away?
Yeah.
No. Uh-uh. No. No, we would just talk about stuff. And then finally he asked me after, it's kind of jumbled in my mind now.
Mm-hmm.
But there was at one point, we were going to record in my house, like we had done Mellow Gold. I can't remember for which record. I don't know if it was second record, which I didn't do, or if it was for Either Or, but I don't remember. And then he started to make a record with Heat Miser, and they were doing that. They had bought a bunch of gear, and they had set up, they rented a house in Portland, and they just kind of set up in the house. And I think, Elliot and Tony, the drummer, who Tony would always kind of produce those records, they just had a difference of opinion. Elliot was White Album, and Tony was much, much more clean and much more clean kind of production.
Mm-hmm.
And it became unmanageable, and he asked me if we would come up and help, like broker the situation and finish the record.
Oh, I see.
And I think that's how we started it. And then I think we did Either Or.
Well, that's cool though. It was good for you. It's good for him too. You know, until, you know, his untimely passing, but it's always great to have an artist that you really dig that does well, you know, and all of a sudden it just makes you feel doubly good because it's so much to
well,
me.
You know,
it was always fun, you know, to work with somebody that was really cool that I really liked, but it was doubly good when, you know, everybody else realized it as well. You know?
Yeah. That's pretty weird. But also at the same time, it doesn't validate. I mean, it's what's the, I'm like, you know, popularity validates you in some way, but it doesn't validate the art. Like, I hate people judging success on, you know, through with the monetization of it.
Mm, yeah.
Like, you can make a great record and nobody buys it. Doesn't mean it wasn't great.
Yeah, that's true.
That's the point I'm trying to make.
I get it.
Yeah.
So when did you start to collect gear?
Probably in the 80s, I would say. That's, you know, things were a lot cheaper back then.
Yeah. Well, what was the first piece?
Do you remember the $350 1176s?
Yes, unfortunately. and I didn't buy them. And there's so many of those things that, you know, we didn't buy back. Well, I didn't anyway. That we didn't realize what they'd be worth, that we didn't realize how cool they were back then. And it was like people were throwing Fairchilds into the trash.
Oh, I remember when Pat Benatar's husband, you know, the guitar player.
Oh, Neil, yeah. Neil Giraldo. Yeah.
He got a Fairchild. The way I understood it was he just Cherokee gave him one. It wasn't working right, and they couldn't be bothered in the 80s.
Yeah. Well, that was the days of the big budgets. I remember I used to do some work at Cherokee, and did you ever work there much?
Yeah. Well, not much, but some.
What I always found really interesting is how often they would pull the speakers out and put brand new speakers in their monitors and retune it. I mean, they do it once a day if they had to, which, you know, is a huge waste of time and money, but, you know, that's the way that went back then.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on then. How much do you do in the box? Considering that you have a wide array of vintage gear to work with and you have, you know, a nice console and everything, how much do you do in the box?
I do some stuff in the box, but I still, you know, on the other hand, it's still, I still kind of think of it as a tape machine. I break everything out across the console.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not scared of, I like it all.
Where do you do your automation? Do you have automation on the console?
No.
You do it in the box then?
I'll do some stuff in the box. I really work at my mix to kind of get it to like sit.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there'll be rides and stuff, but I spent a lot of time just getting it to really be able to sit in there.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. It's funny because there's a new school of mixing where everything is automated, and it really is everything. You know, there's syllables with EQ on it, and there's, you know, effects for a phrase and everything like that, which I get it. I understand why people are doing it, but it's kind of not the way we were brought up, right? It didn't work that way when we started, for better or for worse.
Or if you were going to do it, it required a big console and a lot of effort.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you remember when you do mixes and the whole band would be there because you needed all the hands.
Oh, yeah. And, God, that was awesome. And it was the final performance.
It was so much fun.
And then we also had Poor Man's Automation, which was work on a section of the song, lay it down, work on the next section of the song, lay it down, and then you cut them all together.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
But, you know, there's things about, there are such good things that come from learning that way that are lost now. And learning that way, meaning, you know, 24-track recording. And I say this sort of incredulously, the limitations of 24-track recording.
Yeah.
Because, 24-track was like an amazing thing, you know? Like, we got 24 tracks.
Yeah, yeah.
But it forces you to make decisions and commit.
Yeah.
And you're making sounds and you're committing to these sounds. And again, you're collecting performances and you're collecting sounds and you're reacting to these things and you're reacting and then having another moment and committing another sound to this thing that you're reacting to and you're fitting them all together. So by the end of the record, of the recording time, you have sounds and performances that go together. You're not dragging, like, I can't tell you how many times I mix stuff and you open up these sessions and there's five mics on the guitars and a zillion on the drums. And it's like, what the fuck are you guys doing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How did you get anything done? You're dragging all this stuff around, never making a decision, and nothing ever sounds like anything. You're always like, well, I could turn up this mic, I could turn up that mic, we can hear more of this speaker here. Make a blend. Get rid of some of that shit, you know? Make it be one track.
Well,
if everything's stereo, nothing's stereo.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. I started on 8-track, and an 8-track Scully, as a matter of fact.
And what year did you start?
76.
Wow, cool. And what was the console?
The MCI.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then from there, went to an API with an MCI 24 track. So it was a big step up. But I never regret the 8-track because, and I almost feel like people should learn on 8-track now because, as you say, those limitations are freeing. Because once you learn how to work within them, then everything else is like gravy. It's easy after that.
Yeah. You know, I say learn on an 8-track and listen to a Creedence record.
Yeah, right, exactly, sure.
You know, everything's there. They were made on 8-track. Everything you could possibly need in the song, listen to a Creedence single. It's all there.
Yeah.
There's a lead guitar, there's a harmony, there's percussion, there's drums and bass, and there's an acoustic.
Yeah, I mean, we wouldn't even call that a demo these days. You and I think differently about it, but, you know, generally speaking, that's not even enough to be a demo in many people's eyes. And yet those were great records back then. They still hold up today. And it's like, well, why can't you do it like that? Right?
Yeah. I was talking to Jim Scott about this, you know, being big fans of Harvest.
Yeah.
That record would never come out now.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It would be remixed. You know, it'd be all that modern, the foibles of modern business. And it would, yeah, they wouldn't have that charm. It wouldn't have, completely different time.
I know what you mean. Tell me about the vintage instruments that you have, or just the instruments, because I was looking over your list, and there's some pretty cool stuff.
Let's see. Well, I have, like, your basic requirements, old Les Paul, old Tele, Strat, good old. So I got 53 Les Paul Gold Top, this really cool, it's like a 64 body, 65 neck Tele that, you know, it's like super microphonic and lively and it's awesome. And, you know, I think there's something about, over waxing pickups now, like everybody does it and there's take some of the personality out of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
There's something about them being kind of microphonic and unwieldy that makes them have a lot of life.
Yeah. Yeah.
A good old Jazzmaster. So the core, this is what I find to be the core, is the Tele, Jazzmaster, Epiphone Riviera with flats on it to 12 string.
Oh man.
Les Paul, and SG Junior. And then you have, I got an old J50 and a old Epiphone Texan.
Mm.
And that gets you pretty far down the road. And then, you know, then there's a bunch of other stuff that has its moment. It's sort of like, you know, going to the bullpen to pitch to the lefty. You know, you got this guy with this one pitch that lefties can't hit.
Yeah.
That's how a bunch of these other guitars are. It's like, oh, we got this little sonic space, you know.
Yeah.
Let's, you know, grab the guild, jam it in there. It's going to fit great. So that's how I kind of view it, is like between amps and guitars, you know, you don't have to have EQ.
Yeah.
You can kind of like shape it through the amp and the guitar.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the way I always felt. What kind of amps do you have?
I got a lot of, I got really into those old Gibsons between 54, 57.
Mm, yeah.
So like a GA9, a 20, a 30, a 40. I think it's GA8. They're you know, they have kind of different tubes than the fan. Some of them have these like pentodes in them as their first preamp tube, and they kind of have a different sound, and then they kind of will get into that Tweed Deluxe-y thing as well, and for a fraction of the cost.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Then, you know, the normal suspects, AC30, AC50, Marshalls, and then a bunch of weird stuff for the, you know, there's like the Garnets from Canada, like that BTO sound.
Yeah.
Those are cool. Some old Selmers, which are awesome.
Yeah.
That's probably one of my secret weapon guitar amps that just work all the time on everything.
You and Jimmy Page.
You use Selmers?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Cool.
And not all the time, but yeah. He did use them. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, they're cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
You know, like they do this, like this one is it's a 70s. It's really ugly looking. So they don't, they're still really affordable, but it's like it's called a treble and bass 50. Treble and bass 50R, I think, because it has reverb. But it's just like, shiny. It just does this thing in between like Marshall and Vox, kind of got this chime to it. It always is clear, you can always hear all the strings, and then it'll get some teeth on it, you know.
Yeah, very cool.
It doesn't take up too, yeah, it's not like super, it doesn't get all woofy and anyways. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, guitars and amps, that could go on for days.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. That's
old Mellotron.
Oh, really? Wow.
Well, no, actually, it's a newer Mellotron. It's the, I had an old one. I think Richard has that one now. And then I got one of those reissues where they kind of fixed the funky stuff and then kept everything else the same, and it's great. It's the Mark VI.
Mm-hmm.
And what? 4 tape racks.
Wow.
And it's interesting, again, you know, some of this stuff does not affect sales, but inspiring.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a lot more inspiring than using the plugin.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean.
You know, it's like you want a different sound. It's like, okay, we're going to take her apart. And, you know, people get out their camera and they start taking pictures like, whoa, that's cool. And it is. It's cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, it's one of the cooler things, cooler instruments. There's nothing else like it, really.
It's like that and a, you know, the like ARP string ensemble.
Oh yeah,
God,
yeah.
Those two, it's just so much vibe. I love those things.
I used to have one. I wish I still did, actually.
Oh my God, all that stuff we used to have.
Oh, I don't even want to think about all the cool stuff that I get rid of over the years. Some of it for the right reason. Some of it was because I needed money at the time. That's always a good reason to dump something. Although, you know, you look back later and you go, I could have got the money another way, you know. But some of it for the wrong reason, because you think, I'm not using this. I'll just dump it.
I wish there was a way to make a museum of things people sold for drugs.
Oh, that would be classic. That'd be classic.
There'd be some incredible stuff in there.
Yeah, definitely. All right. One last question for you. So what's the best piece of music advice that you've ever received from somebody or you learned along the way? Could be about the music business or music advice, anything like that.
Well, somebody once said to me, you know, it's a very small business. So, and it was sort of like, you know, don't be an asshole.
Yeah. Yeah.
As big as you might think it is. And it wasn't that I was being an asshole. It wasn't that. They were just saying it's a small business.
Yeah.
You know, and you see it like when, I think that was something to keep in mind, like, interesting. And, you know, it is about relationships.
Yeah, it is. And you meet everybody eventually, it seems, right?
Yeah. But it really is about relationships, and it's great when you have them.
Yeah. And it hurts when you don't.
It does. Yeah. Because, you know, when you're hiring, like when a band is hiring an experienced manager, you know what they're hiring is they're hiring their relationships.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah. I would think that. And the other thing is play your cards close.
How so?
Well, I don't know. I've learned stuff that it was absolutely none of my business because people talk too much.
Oh yeah. I see what you're saying.
And then, you know, you all of a sudden you find out the political minefield of something. And, so it was like, oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. That was interesting. That's been an interesting experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know what? And none of that stuff is like, none of that stuff is like stuff I like or care about. I like all this. I'm all about that. That's like the business side, which I've kind of tried to stay away from at this point. I just really, it's weird. I really like making records, and it's way more, even though the business budget wise is a fraction of what it used to be, I'm having so much more fun, and I find it so much more artistic and creative because it's more direct.
Well, yeah, you're dealing more with the artists these days, especially when it comes to budget, because there's so many indie projects, right? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. And it's just kind of like you get together and you make something that you all like.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're done and they put it out.
Yeah.
And it's cool. It doesn't get fucked up by, you know, everybody hedging their bets.
Yeah. As record labels tend to do, and managers. So, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and nothing great happens from 40 people weighing in on it.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks, Rob. Have a good mix.
All right. Thanks.
You can find out more about Rob at robschnaff.com. That's Rob, RobSchnaff.com. All one word, robschnaff.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyointercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He helps put the show together. Many thanks, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to BobbyOinnerCircle.com or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, or Google Play. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOinnerCircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.